Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up. 5 million coronavirus cases worldwide and still counting. World-famous epidemiologist Peter Piot, who helped discover Ebola, joins us with the latest on a vaccine and what he learned from his own brush with COVID. Then, a person, not a statistic, a sister's heartfelt poem giving a human face to the dead. Also ahead.
We are not all in it together. We haven't been, and we're not all in it together in the pandemic.
Writer Anand Giridharadas tells our Hari Srinivasan how this plague exposes inequality in America and what Congress can learn from mafia movies. Plus,
I call myself the gangster gardener because to me, having knowledge is gangster.
Getting our hands dirty to clean up our minds, the undeniable therapeutic that is nature and gardening. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour, working from home in London. Coronavirus cases are surging past 5 million worldwide, and most of the new cases come from just four countries: the United States, Russia, Brazil, and India. But to be human is also to be hopeful, and the British pharmaceutical giant AstraZeneca has raised hopes now by saying that it could supply 400 million doses of a vaccine from September. The company is working with Oxford University, which is one of a handful of places currently holding human trials. That September date is, of course, entirely dependent on those trial results and a vaccine being developed. For more on this, I'm joined now by one of the world's leading epidemiologists, Dr. Peter Piot. He co-discovered Ebola back in 1976, and now, more than 40 years later, the virus has finally got him. That is the coronavirus, of course. And he's joining me now from his home in London. Dr. Piot, really welcome back to our program. It really struck us, you know, with a shiver when we heard that you, of all people, had got coronavirus. You're back. But tell me what happened. How do you think you got it? How did it affect you?
Hello, Christiane. Good to see you again. And actually, it's all started the last time that we talked on the 19th of March when I was in your program. And that day I developed high fever, a splitting headache, muscle pain everywhere, and particularly a growing exhaustion. And so that's 2 months ago, and I'm still not fully recovered. As you may hear, my voice is still a bit funny, a bit hoarser. And I ended up in the hospital for 7 days where I needed oxygen support. And when that was all over, I thought it was over. I developed a so-called organizing pneumonia. In other words, there was a hyperimmune reaction of my body against the virus. It was no longer the virus, and that was infiltrating my lungs. And so I suspect there will be lots of people with chronic morbidity, with sequelae. And, you know, it made me what, in my native language, Dutch, what we call an experienced expert. Up to now, for 4 decades, I've been fighting viruses from Ebola to HIV. And now I thought, okay, a virus got me. And it was like being hit by a bus where the virus gets into every single cell of your body. And it shows also that COVID-19 is more than, you know, lots of people get a bit of a flu and then 1% die. And then often they say, oh, it's only people over 70 and I'm 71, or people with underlying diseases. No, there's a lot in between, and a lot of people who, you know, will suffer from lung affections, from heart problems, kidney problems and so on. So that is really gave me a new insight. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you, you got there before me. I was going to say, did you learn new stuff about COVID after experiencing it and seeing the after effects on yourself? And clearly that seems to be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. This is not like some people say, oh, it's like influenza, it's like the flu. Influenza doesn't give you this prolonged, exhaustion for months. And morbidity of any organ can be affected by this coronavirus, which is totally new. But also, it makes a big difference whether you've experienced something yourself or when you're studying it or fighting it. I mean, I learned that from people living with HIV, who are often telling us what works, what doesn't work, or women who survive breast cancer. So it's time that we are not only going to communicate about figures and so on, but also people's experience. But also it made me, of course, even more determined to fight the virus.
Mm-hmm. Well, the obvious question is how. I just want to read a little bit because you did write a very affecting article about your experience. Partly you said, I've devoted my life to fighting viruses and finally they get their revenge. For a week, I balanced between heaven and earth on the edge of what could have been the end. It really does sound terribly dramatic. And I just wondered whether you can just explain also, I don't know, the psychology, if you had any space for that. What was it like being in hospital? We hear about the loneliness, the separation between those who are ill and their loved ones, and just the unique qualities of this particular disease.
Yeah, first of all, you're totally exhausted, so there is not much space in even in your brain for lots of things. Your world shrinks, and it shrinks like thinking of my wife Heidi and my kids, and that was about it. But also I was there with three other men who were suffering from the same problem, hardly any communication because we were completely exhausted. But it's the isolation. We couldn't get out of there, we could not receive visitors. But I was saying, okay, fortunately, we have technology today. There is the mobile phone and we can even, we can see each other. If this would have happened, let's say 30, 40 years ago, no cell phones and even 10 years ago, very difficult to have, video communication. So that really helped. But it's the loneliness. And fortunately, mm-hmm. I was not in, the intensive care where people die just completely on their own, and that's terrible.
And quickly, Dr. Pierre, well, not quickly, explain to us, because you also say that you were just dreading the idea of a ventilator being, intubated into you. Luckily, well, fortunately, you needed oxygen and not a ventilator. But you see, this is really interesting because ventilator, ventilator, ventilator has been the mantra since the beginning, but you were afraid that if you actually got it, you might die with a ventilator.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt that ventilators, when they're needed, that they can save lives. But, what is far more needed is oxygen. Oxygen, that's what most people can, get most people through their, very low oxygen saturation levels. And with ventilators, we should be very selective. So, and I'm thinking particularly about low-income countries with the London School of Hygiene Tropical Medicine. We work a lot in Africa and in India, and they always say we need ventilators. Well, there's no oxygen, and I think with oxygen, we'll be able to, to save far more lives than with a few ventilators, although both are needed. So we have to put these things in perspective.
Yeah, so that's really important. And again, let me just repeat that I'm not just asking an eminent epidemiologist about his experience. You are the world's leading virologist, epidemiologist, and you and your school were responsible, along with Imperial College, for, the models that led to a late, but nonetheless, a lockdown here in Britain. You had these models that showed that if there wasn't a lockdown, there were going to be potentially hundreds of thousands of dead here and maybe more than a million in the United States. The lockdowns have prevented that. So I want to ask you, since you are Dr. Peter Piot, what you make of the latest in terms of vaccines. We've heard the President of the United States and now AstraZeneca. We've heard Moderna in the United States. Basically, the human trials are taking place. And I want to know from your perspective, when you think that they will be available, the vaccines.
Well, when we hear a lot about an exit strategy, you know, and that's really important. But the only real exit should come from science, I think, and that's from a vaccine, which will protect us from becoming infected and from dying. There are about, as far as I know, there are 8 candidate vaccines now in clinical trials in people in so-called phase 1, and about maybe 30 that are, you know, will soon go into clinical trials. So there's a lot of activity going on. And this week there was some encouraging news that both the Moderna vaccine, candidate vaccine, which is based on injecting the genetic material, the messenger RNA, in the body so that the body will produce its own vaccine, that they said that in mice, it prevents pneumonia, and also that in a small number of people, in 8 people, it elicited so-called neutralizing antibodies. These are antibodies that neutralize, that kill off the virus. And that is one of the usual requirements for a vaccine to work. And then there's a totally different vaccine that was developed by Oxford University, as you mentioned, with AstraZeneca now. And that's also an approach that is being used by a company in China, CanSino, and by Johnson & Johnson. And they have demonstrated in macaques, in monkeys, that the vaccine protects the monkeys from pneumonia. However, the monkeys also continue to excrete the virus, from their noses. So we have to really go an all-out effort to make sure that we can develop a vaccine. And there are many things that have to happen there. First of all, you have to demonstrate that it works, that it protects not only young people, but also the most vulnerable in society. In other words, older people, and they're sometimes, vaccines are less effective. So they have to demonstrate that. And the only way to find out is to do these large-scale human trials. But secondly, there's also a safety issue. You mentioned that a promise of producing a few hundred million vaccines, but the truth is that we need billions, not millions. We need probably 5-6 billion doses of this vaccine, and that means it has to be absolutely safe. Again, that requires quite some long trials. And thirdly, we need to manufacture billions of vaccines. That capacity at the moment is not necessarily there. So we shouldn't wait until we know whether a vaccine works or not. We already have to make sure that that manufacturing capacity is there. And then lastly, we need to make sure once these vaccines are there, and when I talk about billions, we need to make sure it's the nitty-gritty. Are there billions of small glass vials to put these vaccines in? Probably not. So we need to produce all that. And then lastly, we need to make sure that everybody who needs it gets this vaccine, and that it's not really limited to a few countries that produce these vaccines.
From your experience, do you think that that will happen, that very important fact? China has said that it must, you know, it would help and support a people's vaccine. In other words, something that's available to everyone. Others have said so. We don't know whether it's going to be available to everyone, regardless of their, you know, ability to pay for it.
Well, there is something, a new word now that's coming up, and that's vaccine nationalism, where countries will say, okay, the vaccine that's produced in our country will go to our citizens. And I understand that that's a concern for every government. But vaccine development and manufacturing is a very, very restricted business, in the sense that very few companies do it. And so most countries in the world do not produce any vaccine. So, and they also should have access. That's why some initiatives are really important. For example, on the 1st of May, Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, together with a number of countries, with the Gates Foundation, with the Wellcome Trust, with CEPI, with WHO, announced an initiative and raised money for it already up to now to $8 billion to make sure that not only that these vaccines and therapeutics also and diagnostics are being developed, but also that they would become available for those in need in various European countries, because that's her, you know, her domain politically, but also in poorer nations such as in Africa, which all will need to have access to this vaccine. So this is going to become, I think, a big political issue for the future.
And where, if you're looking now at the future and you see this first wave in many countries is being wrangled right now, you see easing of lockdowns in many parts of the world. What do you predict for the next, I don't know, in the fall and then in the winter? And where do you predict this virus will go? And what is the key now, without a vaccine, without the therapeutic, to a safe exit?
Yeah, it is predictable that we will see several waves of infections with these vaccines. The good news is that now that many countries, at least in Asia and in Europe, in some states in the US, that the number of new infections and the number of deaths is going down. That allows for a trade-off with, resuming societal and economic activity, and it will always be a trade-off. So that's a good news. However, we need to learn some lessons from the initial responses, because they will be very important for dealing with new outbreaks that will come. And the first and most important lesson is act early. When you look at Europe, for example, a country like Germany was very early on, massively testing, acted very early on, and has, low number of infections and particularly low number of deaths. Other countries, including the UK, were a bit late. We'll need to apply the same thing, when we need a massive surveillance. By that I mean massive testing to know where, in the fall, in winter, whenever, that new cases are appearing. And as soon as there is an increase, we need to put in place really serious measures, not necessarily a lockdown. I think if we are massively testing and we know where the epidemic is, a new outbreak is, we can isolate people, we can look for contacts. By that time, we may have some therapeutics that could be given to the contacts of people, so as a kind of preventive measure, so-called prophylaxis. So that will be important. So, and then I think here technology is going to be extremely important. Not only testing, because testing is not available enough in many countries. And but that's a matter of logistics, of organizing it, but also having an army of contact tracers, people who look for all those who have been in touch with the case. But then also technology, the apps that are now being developed and being introduced in many countries that tell you whether you've been close to someone with COVID-19 infection. And so that will be really, really important for early detection and early action. But that early action depends on strong leadership. It's not enough to have the technology and the data if there's no action on it. And people have to be involved in all this. So that is really the new phase that we're going into. But it will be less of a bulldozer approach where, a lockdown of entire societies, but more really targeted. We still have a big problem in care homes in this country and in many other countries. In many people become infected in the hospital, healthcare workers who then infect people in their community, in their little prisons. So we need to concentrate our efforts where the virus is.
Yep.
And then we can make a difference. But that requires absolutely up-to-date information and lots of testing.
Yeah, I hear you very loud and clear. Testing, tracing, surveillance, they must get that up and running. And we hope they will do that sooner rather than later, obviously. Dr. Peter Piot, thank you so much for joining us. And we're glad that you're on our program for the first time since you're better. So we're very pleased to have you back. Thank you so much. Now, every day we report the numbers of those who've died from this unforgiving virus. And it's important that we do so. But we want to pause now to think about the people behind those numbers. More than a quarter of coronavirus deaths here in the UK have been in care homes. And in the United States, they account for 20% of the death toll. But behind every statistic is a life cut short and a person who loved and who was loved. Rose Mitchell was 81 years old when she died from COVID-19 in a care home here in London last month. And afterwards, her sister wrote a powerful poem. She said, "My sister is not a statistic." And that was to memorialize her life. Dorothy Duffy joins me now from her home here in London. Dorothy Duffy, we're very pleased to have you on our program. You just heard from the greatest virologist around that care homes have been a very difficult place, and your sister sadly died there. I just want to know from you personally, what was it like when she was sick? What, were you able to have any contact? What was the situation for you and for her?
My sister was moved from hospital into a care home within a few days of lockdown. And so very quickly, and not long after she had moved in, we were advised that we couldn't actually see her. So she was blind, and she was becoming quite forgetful. So trying to help her conceptualize what lockdown was, what COVID-19, it was like something from a science fiction novel for her to understand. So we were unable to see her in person. Her daughter Karen had filled her room with all her familiar clothing, her pictures, even though she couldn't see them. We wrote her emails and letters, and the care home staff, who were wonderful, read them out to her. So we were telling her about what was happening in our daily lives and how much we loved her, etc. But it was heartbreaking and heartrending not to be able to see her and to know that she couldn't fully comprehend why it was she wasn't able to see her children, especially, and her loved ones and her grandchildren. But we were in contact by phone, and we were in contact via letters, which the staff read out. And one that her daughter wrote to her, the care home manager, Dominic, rang her and said, "I've just read your letter to your mum, and she's just fallen into a lovely sleep." It just reminded me that it was a bit like a bedtime story.
Yeah, and it's so important because you're talking about the human, you know, the human contact and how so many of the carers were such humanitarians and really did try to do everything they could for people in their care. You've also, though, said, you know, talking about it afterwards and writing your poem, you called the sort of daily, you know, focus on it a sort of like the daily deathometer, the statistics, you know, and you are a family who, you know, humanized those statistics. And you've said your poem to Rose, who was 81, you know, you referenced throwaway lines, platitudes, the description of the dead as an older person with underlying health conditions. And I wonder if you could maybe read for us a little excerpt of the poem that you wrote for your sister afterwards.
Yes, of course. My sister is not a statistic. Tomorrow, when the latest deathometer of COVID is announced in sonorous tones, my sister will be among those numbers. Among the throwaway lines, among the platitudes and lowered eyes, an older person with underlying health conditions. A pitiful way to lay rest the bare bones of a life. My sister is not a statistic. Her underlying conditions were love, kindness, belief in the essential goodness of mankind, uproarious laughter, forgiveness, compassion, a storyteller, a survivor, a comforter, a force of nature, and so much more. My sister is not a statistic. She died without the soft touch of a loved one's hand, without a feathered kiss upon her forehead, without the muted murmur of familiar family voices gathered round her bed. Without the gentle roar of laughter that comes with memories recalled, evoked from a time that already seems distant, when we were connected by the simplicity of touch, of voice, of presence.
It's really beautiful, and of course I can hear your grief and your sadness in your voice. I just want to know, lastly, what you hope that publicly reading this, having publicly posted it, and it went viral all over the place, it was very well received. What do you want people to know, and has it helped you with your grief?
I want people to know that my sister had a full, long, wonderful life and a zest for living. She loved people. She was probably the kindest person I've ever met in my life. And she gave so much to people and she got so much back. So when those daily statistics come out, and I know that the people who have lost loved ones will feel it, that those, they're not statistics, they are loved ones that are now have left a hole in someone's life, in a family's life, in a loved one's life. And the manner in which they died meant that towards the end, they weren't able to be with them. And I would just, it has helped me in my grief because I've had so many messages from people who said that it articulated what they felt. And I just hope that when the process for dealing effectively with the ongoing transmission of this virus, that it is done in the memory and with love for all of those who have died, whether or not they had underlying health conditions. They should not be defined by that, and they should not be remembered by that. They should be remembered as being loved ones who had a life and were loved.
Well, Dorothy Duffy, thank you so much. You have really made that message and sent it loud and clear to all of us. Thank you so much. And of course, with all this grief, the stress and the loneliness, ahead on the program, we have a little bit of an antidote. Really, the incredible medical benefits of connecting with nature. That's ahead. But first, this pandemic has prompted a lot of us to reflect on how the world works and, importantly, who it works for. That's at the heart of a new program called Seat at the Table on Vice TV from writer and best-selling author Anand Giridharadas. He has made a career of questioning the seat of power and money in America. And now he tells our Hari Srinivasan why society really needs to adapt or fail.
Thanks, Christiane. Anand, thanks for joining me. This entire period seems like a strange time to start an entirely new television program, but what has been revelatory for you? What are you talking with your guests about?
It's interesting. We conceived of Seat at the Table and set it up right before we realized what was going to happen with the pandemic. So we had a complete, briefly sketched plan for a normal world TV show. And the idea in that phase was thinking about power, thinking about the fact that the central issue in American life, in my view, is the imbalance of power, the concentration of power, power allied with wealth, and that that was often reflected in what you see on a lot of cable news. The kind of interests of power, the ideas of power, reflected more than those of the powerless. And we wondered if we could change that. Then the pandemic struck. So there was a logistical element of that. Suddenly we're all dispersed. Everybody's on, you know, Zoom and figuring out, can you make a TV show when everybody's separate on Zoom? Turns out you actually can, thanks to the remarkable technologies we have in this time. But actually the mission didn't have to change at all, because I think the thesis about power was amplified by the pandemic rather than changed. You know, we often say the pandemic's unprecedented. It's not unprecedented. It's a building on the mega trends of the last 30 or 40 years, including the growing consolidation of power. And, you know, another thing we say is we're all in it together. We are not all in it together. We haven't been, and we're not all in it together in the pandemic. And so those have become the issues we're digging into even more deeply, trying to understand why the pandemic has unfolded the way it has in America, which is different from South Korea, different from Germany, as you know, different from all kinds of other places. The virus wasn't a product of plutocracy and oligarchy in America, but the way in which the virus has affected us is very much a product of those social conditions.
When you say we're not all in this together, you mean what? That we're all impacted differently? That that's how it's separate for us?
In many ways. So first of all, just in terms of who is dying from this plague, in many parts of this country, it is literally a black plague. It is a plague that is killing African Americans at substantially higher rates than other communities. And that is for a whole host of reasons, including health access people have, including doctors not listening to people, and so on and so forth. So we're not all in it together in terms of who is living and who is dying. But we're also not in it together in terms of everybody else who doesn't have the thing but is affected by the economic and social upheaval that this is. You know, who gets to be someone who works from home? That is not evenly distributed either. If you look at even racially, the fraction of white people who have a job that allows them to continue working from home versus the fraction of blacks and Latinos who can do that, it's just really, really different. And if you look at the precarity of employment in the last many years, the increasing precarity, the rise of the gig economy. You know, Uber drivers are kind of all of us as Silicon Valley has deepened its hold on the economy, and you have this notion of people, you know, being contracted out to work through apps that actually often steal some of their money and steal their tips. Well, you know, we've now realized that employing millions of people in this precarious way results in massive social calamities that are a choice, right? The virus isn't a choice, but to have tens of millions of people with instantly no security, no savings, out on the street, so to speak, is a product of social choices we have made that other societies, you know, chose more wisely to do differently.
When you talk about choice, there's also, I mean, one of the segments on your program recently, it was called, I think, The War on Government. There's a pretty sizable movement among supporters of the president that seems pro-freedom. It also seems anti-government. We recently had the author and professor Tom Nichols on, and he said, you know what, that freedom is confused with the type of freedom that children have. But you also went on in your program and talked about how there is a certain tyranny in life with no government at all. Explain that.
You know, many Americans have a childlike understanding of freedom, as you say. And what that consists of is an understanding of freedom, which in many ways goes back to our founding, of freedom obsession, I would say, these Americans have, in which freedom is defined as the absence of government. Now, or government doing as little as possible, or government leaving you alone. Now, I would be the first to say that is an element of freedom. There's a whole bunch of things, right, that I don't want the government intervening in my life, and I share that. I think everyone listening to this would share that. But for a great number of Americans with this infantile understanding of freedom, that is it. That is freedom. Freedom is being left alone by government, and it's being paranoid about government being way more interested in you than you are actually interesting, right? Government's coming for your guns. Government's coming to, you know, regulate your food away. Government's coming to, you know, tell you who you can meet. Government's coming to manipulate you through, you know, its allies in the fake news. I mean, this kind of paranoid attitude, government coming to get you. And the point we made on the segment was what this has done is obscure the way in which a large aspect of human freedom is actually not threatened by government, but by private actors, right? A bank screwing you over, speculating in ways that lead to you losing your home is also a threat to your freedom. Doesn't mean government's not a threat to your freedom, but the threat can also come from over there, right? A company dumping toxic chemicals into the creek where your kids play, right, is also threatening your freedom and their freedom, but it's not government. And what we have often failed to understand as a culture, and certainly these millions of Americans who feel this way, is that when the threats actually come from private actors, your best bet against those kinds of threats are the government. If you are hungry because you're paid $7 an hour instead of 15, the government is your best bet to make sure you get paid 15. There's not another easy way to make that happen. And so this childlike freedom obsession that tens of millions of Americans unfortunately have is literally killing us in this pandemic, because they are so focused on government oppressing them through lockdowns that they don't understand that you can end up way more oppressed by a virus. You can end up way more oppressed by not having economic security. You can end up way more oppressed by having the kind of healthcare system that encourages people to stay home instead of get tested.
Right now, we are in an unprecedented time of government spending. I mean, we've passed literally trillions of dollars out the door. Has the government stepped up to help with this stimulus package?
You know, the stimulus is not only a question of amounts, but about how wisely you disperse the money. So you can have stimulus that is cornered by big business, as happened with the Paycheck Protection Program, or you can have stimulus that really goes to regular people. I mean, I've been seeing stories from across Europe where, you know, freelancers just suddenly woke up to money being deposited into their accounts by the government because they recognized that freelancers would need it in this time, right? That's just our society could work that way. We just choose to have it not work that way. And then there's this notion of conditionalities. The economist Mariana Mazzucato talks about this. It's the notion that if you're going to be giving companies a lot of money when they're desperate, they're on their knees begging for the government's money, this is an extraordinary time to ask them for a couple things, right? Normally, in the absence of a crisis, these companies have a lot of power, and they got these lobbyists, and it's hard to get regulatory things done on them. Well, when they're begging, it's a good time to ask for what you want. So you do conditionalities. Conditionalities are, okay, you want this paycheck protection plan. You want this kind of bailout of whatever. We would like you to institute these environmental protections. We would like you to, you know, not spend money in politics. We would like you to pay your workers this much. We would like you to commit to these kinds of retraining programs after the pandemic. People, like, you can ask companies for what you want. That's kind of the whole idea. Because taking the money, they don't have to do it, right? It's actually your money. So you are giving companies money, which may be a shock if you don't have a lot of money that you are actually giving companies money, but you are. And so if you're giving companies money, like the airlines, it's time to ask some things you want. You know what? I don't like those overhead charges. I don't like the fact that you bust the unions of the flight attendants. I don't like the fact that I can't, you know, change my ticket when I have a, you know, problem in my family without spending $500. And you just say to the airlines, you want this bailout money? Here's what we want. The people who are giving you this money. It's a very basic concept that should be understandable to anyone who's ever watched a mafia movie. But somehow this idea of conditionalities hasn't really dawned on the United States Congress. And it's very, very important that it does in any future relief.
This is also an era where we're seeing largesse by billionaires. And you've written about this extensively for your book, Winners Take All. When you look out at press releases, proclamations, initiatives funded by billionaires, what goes through your mind?
You know, the virus, again, has only amplified what we've been seeing for the last many years, which is some of the richest and most powerful people, stepping up with these pledges of lavish help. But I think one of the things that I found missing from a lot of this conversation that I've been trying to articulate is that this very billionaire class that is stepping up to help in the pandemic is in many ways responsible for why the pandemic has unfolded in the way it has in America.
Explain that.
So if you look at why government has been discredited, intellectually discredited, defunded, defanged from a regulatory point of view, why we shut down pandemic prevention offices, for example, who does that? Working people? Is working people advocating for dismantling government? It is very much a product of corporate interests, lobbying in Washington, sometimes succeeding under Democratic administrations, more often succeeding under Republican administrations, to yank out regulation, cut funding, cut taxes so the government can do less, right? The way the pandemic has unfolded in America is inseparable from that discrediting, defanging, and defunding of government. And so when I see the very same class of people stepping up, I see arsonists returning to the scene of a fire and putting on a costume and claiming to be firefighters. In many ways, what they are doing is trying to buy mercy on the cheap so we don't actually fix this society in a way that reduces their power and makes us not so vulnerable the next time a pandemic like this or something else rolls around.
You know, I can hear a CEO or someone who's justifying the market saying they're just responding to shareholders. They are acting in their rational self-interest as stewards of specific companies, that we don't necessarily have a system right now that rewards excess capacity in hospitals or having extra masks on hand. How do you change that?
Many ways. But first of all, if we, you are right about one thing very important here, which is if we want companies that take care of the commons, we should change corporate law to require stakeholder capitalism, right? The Business Roundtable, big lobbying group of the biggest companies last year, you know, claimed to do a big deal statement where they said the purpose of business is no longer just to make money for shareholders, but to account for all stakeholders. Unfortunately, you know, I confronted Jamie Dimon about this when he reached out to me to address my skepticism of this. And I said, you know, Jamie, why don't you, like, there are legislative policies, proposals out there to take the statement and make it the law. Elizabeth Warren had one where it'd be the law of the land for companies of a certain size to take stakeholders. Jamie, this is perfect for you. You said you want this in a statement. You got Elizabeth Warren who wants to take your statement and you know, do the ultimate retweet of it, which is put it into the law. Oh, no. We don't want to, you know, we wouldn't want to be a police force. These people are not serious. Jamie Dimon is not serious. There's not a seriousness around actually having this be how capitalism works. So they want the moral glow of voluntary virtue, but they don't actually want it to be a rule that companies have to, you know, can't hurt workers, hurt communities, hurt the planet in order to make money. So if you really want companies behaving that way, you got to change the law. Number two, there's a bunch of smaller regulations along the way that are not as big as just the underlying corporate law that actually help people make those decisions in better ways. You know, if you're paying people $15 or $20 an hour as your minimum, you know, you're just not going to have as many billionaires having as many billions, right? You're not going to have the kind of outsized leverage that big companies have if, you know, you have way more working people with way more disposable income contributing to political campaigns as they have been in recent years. We have, in every phase of American life, designed a system that is almost, you know, bespoke, tailored to serve rich people's interests. And the wake-up call is it doesn't have to be like this. So many other countries are not like this, and they still have capitalism. This is what's so shocking to Americans. Do you know that Germany has capitalism? Do you know that all the Scandinavian companies have capitalism, countries have capitalism? They have great companies there, right? Do you know that those countries with universal health care, you talk to business people there, they love having universal health care. You know why? Because they don't have to pay for it. Their companies, they don't have to actually think about it. When they're starting a small business, they don't have to have this huge expense of paying for people, right? When they're trying to recruit people to their small businesses, they don't have to deal with this problem of people not wanting to leave a big company because they're going to lose their health care. It is actually better to live in a decent society. And when Americans start to wake up to that in greater numbers, it's going to be a great day.
The new show is called Seat at the Table on Vice TV. Anand Giridharadas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And on Keeping Them Honest There, that show is going to be must-watch television. Now, and finally, during this pandemic, many of us are struggling, of course, in such uncertain times. Looking after our mental health is, of course, more important than ever now. Studies show that connecting with nature can lift our spirits and much more, something our next guests know all about. Sue Stewart-Smith is a psychiatrist and she's an author. She's just written The Well-Gardened Mind, which will be released in the United States July 7th. It's already out here in the UK. And also joining us, Ron Finley, aka the Gangster Gardener. His TED Talk has been watched by millions. He's inspired dozens of community gardens around Los Angeles where he lives, and he's also given a masterclass, and they both join me now. Let me start with you, Sue Stewart-Smith, The Well-Gardened Mind. It's an amazing book to come out right now when everybody is either baking bread or trying as much as they can to connect in some way with nature. Not everybody has that opportunity. So I just want to ask you some of the real sort of touchstones and analysis and science that you've found writing this book about what it can do to people's mental health.
Well, it's no surprise, really, that people have been turning to nature in such a big way in response to this crisis. And if we look at history, it's a recurring theme, you know, during wars, following wars, following natural disasters. We need to turn back to the land, and nature's powers of restoration and natural beauty is very sustaining to us. So it's something that's happened before many, many times over. And as you mentioned, the pandemic has opened up the divide, the social economic divide between those who have gardens and those who don't. Because for people who have them, they've been able to appreciate their gardens more than ever before. And I hope that in some measure that might lead to an understanding of how restorative gardens can be for mental health. And, you know, lead to things like horticultural therapy being taken a bit more seriously.
Yeah, well, let me just ask Ron, because I want to get back to the psychology and the statistics with you in a second, Sue. But I want to ask Ron, who's joining us now from Los Angeles. Ron, you call yourself the Gangster Gardener. And it's, you know, you've done something in L.A. that probably nobody did. You have turned verges of highways and various land into thriving gardens. Why did you decide to do this? What sort of led you to that place?
Real simple, beauty in, beauty out, and how are you? Because people think health is just what you put into your mouth, and it's not. Health is your environment. Health is what you see every day. Health is, can you smell beauty? Can you look at beauty every day? So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to beautify my community.
No, it wasn't just beauty there, was it? Because, I mean, I think, you know, you talk about, many people talk about a food desert in L.A., but you talk a little bit about, you know, a food prison, and you're trying to get people to also understand about, as you say, beauty in, beauty out, but what the quality of what you put into your body.
Well, it all goes together. It's just like, you know, most people don't know the single most important thing to your life. They will tell you their family, their daughter, the single most important thing to your life is air, oxygen. But nobody seems to know that because we don't value it. So it's a shotgun blast. It's not a single bullet. You have to affect a lot of things at the same time. And yes, the health disparities are in my communities, in black, brown, red, communities across the planet are a lot of times worse than they are in other communities with other persuasions. And that's by design. So I'm a designer. So I'm trying to change the design. You shouldn't have to be well-heeled to eat healthy food. And that's why I started this. Yeah. I mean, the liquor stores are by design. The fast food places are by design. Why aren't they in these other affluent communities like that? You know, and it's constantly making us sick.
Talking about sick, Sue, you are a psychiatrist, and you, part for your book and basically your research over the years, you went to Rikers Island Prison in New York, where there's something like 8,000 inmates there. What did you discover about those who could garden and those who couldn't? Just what did you discover about some of the key stats that everybody worries about about prisoners, you know, when they're released, reoffending rates and the like?
Well, the program in Rikers Island is run by the HORT, the Horticultural Society of New York. And what their program shows is that the prisoners who complete their program and who go on and to the community program called the Green Team have a much lower level of reoffending. The usual rate of reoffending is about 60%. And for the Green Team participants, it's as low as 10 to 15%, which is a remarkable difference. Some other prison projects have similar findings as well. And I think key to it all is actually this very accessible form of creativity and an empowering and self-esteeming effect that comes from being able to make something good happen, you know, to grow pumpkins or to grow tasty tomatoes or beauty, as Ron's saying. You know, there are lots of beautiful flowers in the eight gardens on Rikers. It's not all about produce, and that's extremely important, I think, just in terms of allowing someone to feel that they might be able to make a change or make a difference to their life.
Mm-hmm. And it does, in fact, the beauty and some of this basically affects neural pathways, right? I mean, there's a scientific correlation between this
health. Yes. Yeah. No, there is. And I think it's very easy to underestimate how, as Ron's saying about simple things, how crucial they are to our neurological functioning as well as our psychology. So, for instance, beauty is very interesting, and there's a neuroscientist called Semi Ezeki who has conducted brain scans, and these showed, regardless of the form of beauty, that the pathways being fired in the brain are the same as those in romantic love. And that means that beauty mm-hmm. stimulates neurotransmitters like endorphins, our natural opioids, serotonin, dopamine. It stimulates our reward pathways, and these are all motivating and invigorating and calming, actually, too. I mean, that's the remarkable thing about gardening, is it has this combined effect of being both calming but vitalizing as well.
Ron, there's an incredible statistic, you know, it says basically Americans on average spend 93% of their time indoors or in a vehicle. And I just wondered what you've noticed, whether you've noticed, you know, how kids react. And are you trying to kind of get them at a young age and teach them about nature and gardening in your community? How's that going?
If kids grow kale, kids eat kale, you know, period. If you expose them to this, that's what's going to happen. I'm trying to teach them that they are nature, that nature's not something you go to the forest to see. When you look in the mirror, you look at nature. We decompose just like a leaf does. We decompose just like Bambi does in the forest. We are the forest. We're carbon. And that's the lessons that we should know. What changed me? What changed my thinking was making compost. This is supposed to be dead stuff. So how is it 150 degrees? How did that happen? You know, we're energy. So if we were taught what we truly are, I think it would change a whole lot of how we look at this planet. Everything on this planet is alive, including the mountains, everything. This planet. And we try to put everything in a box. And you can't do that because if you're in a box, just like a plant, you put it in a box and the roots don't have anywhere to go. So what are they going to do? They're going to suffocate and choke that plant, and it's not going to get the growth that it needs to. It's a duty to teach these kids that they have a responsibility to nature, because if you take care of your mother, you take care of yourself.
And you had an extraordinary situation. Well, first of all, I think I read that you've barely had to leave your own garden during the lockdown because you've pretty much grown everything you've eaten over the last couple of months. But you also have a remarkable story about when you first tried to do this, I think the authorities came and tried to uproot your gardens.
Yeah, I became a criminal because I planted tomatoes. Could you imagine me being in jail and guys asking, yo, homie, what you in for? Yeah, man, I planted some tomatoes on the street, dude, so back off. You know, it's like it was the dumbest thing that you could imagine. And fortunately, I was able to get that law reversed. So now in the whole city of Los Angeles, you can plant edibles on your parkway. My thing is they need to advocate for it. They need to tell people that, and they need to have a team to show people how to do that. No one should have to fight for food. No one should. There's no reason that we should have a skid row with all the money and all the resources that we have. And that's why I say it's all by design. And we're designers. We can change these designs and make these communities where they're healthy for everybody, you know, all the kids. So we do. We have to get to the kids.
Yeah. Yeah, and we understand that kids also, when they go to these forest schools, they get to kind of learn and discover on their own outdoors, find solutions. But finally to you, Sue, you've written in The Well Garden Mind, in this era of virtual worlds and fake facts, the garden brings us back to reality.
It's exactly the kind of realities that Ron is talking about. You know, we have to engage with the natural life cycle. We form a relationship, a very close relationship. Gardening is an intimate relationship. And so we engage in that in a way that becomes about give and take, actually. I think it's that recognition of how we need to care for the planet, to care for ourselves at that basic level.
Indeed, and boy, if we haven't had a signal now, yeah, to care for the planet, this is it. Sue and Ron, thank you so much for joining us. That's wonderful. And that is it for our program tonight. Thank you both very much. Thanks for watching, and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. When you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.